It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis has the week off, but Matthew Ingram's here with Ron Amadio and a preview of what's coming up next week at Google I.O. Stay tuned. A fascinating Twig is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig This Week in Google, episode 352, recorded Wednesday, May 11th, 2016. 12,047,983,037. This Week in Google is brought to you by Ministry of Supply. Ministry of Supply uses performance technology to make your work clothes incredibly comfortable. For performance menswear designed to work with your body, visit ministryofsupply.com/twig and use the code TWIG to get 15% off your first purchase. And by Harry's, for guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com/twig and get $5 off your first order. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Matthew Ingram is here from fortune.com. Great to have you, Matthew, from above the 49th parallel.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, nice to have you. Also here, Mars Technica, Ron Amadio. Hello, Ron.
Hey.
Nice to see
you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Jeff Jarvis has the week off. He's in Mexico City and could not get a good connection, unfortunately, at his hotel. But that's okay. I love these guys. And, of course, there's lots to talk about. Google I.O. is next week. Ron, you're going, right?
Yes, sir. I can't wait. We got hotels booked and plane tickets and meetings and all that. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, I hope you didn't book a hotel in San Francisco, because you should probably know that the Shoreline Amphitheater is considerably south of here.
Yeah, we're close to it, but on the wrong side of a 12-lane highway. So
you can't walk.
We're definitely going to need a car, yeah.
Google I.O. is next week. In fact, our show will be delayed next week because we're going to do coverage of the Google I.O. Wednesday keynote starting at 10 a.m. Pacific. That's 1 p.m. Eastern time, 1700 UTC. No, that's not right. 10 a.m. is, 1700 UTC. The keynote will take place not in the traditional Moscone Center or even inside a venue at Google. It'll take place at a place mostly known for outdoor concerts, the Shoreline Amphitheater. That's where Neil Young has his bridge benefit every year. But it is in Google's backyard. Have they told us how this is going to work?
Yeah, there's a map for Google I.O., and they're just kind of going to fill the parking lot with all sorts of, I guess, tents and event spaces. I don't know. I guess it's going to be like a little tent city, which will be weird. And I'm going to bring sunscreen.
Yeah. Well, it'll be warm. It'll be nice. You're not going, Matthew.
No. No, I'm not, unfortunately. Yeah. I'd love to.
I think Google I.O. is fun. It's ostensibly a developer conference, but Google has so many irons in the fire. It's not, by the way, Ron, is it Alphabet I.O.?
No, it is still Google I.O. I don't think any of the Alphabet companies are going to join in on any of that.
No,
it's Google
Nest.
Show, and it's going to be, nah.
Okay, that's interesting. They're going to show some Google X stuff, I would imagine.
Yeah, Google X is the only group that's ever kind of really participated in I.O. Everybody else is just steered clear of it. Are you guys sending anybody?
Oh, yeah, you bet. Jason Howell will be there. Father
awesome.
Robert Ballester will be there. Jeff Jarvis will be there. And we will, of course, being in the keynote doesn't help us cover it in any way. So I'll be sitting here with our team watching the keynote. They're going to stream it and doing our usual commentary. But then what will happen is after the keynote ends, we're going to get these guys to kind of go somewhere and find a place where they can Skype so that we can have them join on a Twig. So Twig will be probably about 2 p.m. Pacific, be pushed back by everything. Yeah, so what do we expect? What's going to be the big story?
every kind of weird reality thing you can think of. Virtual reality, augmented reality. That's pretty much what kind of takes up the schedule. It's a weird show this year because usually the big deal is a new version of Android, but that already launched.
Android N. We know about that.
Some kind of Android N.
Yeah.
Do you think they'll say anything about Chrome and Android? Like a merger?
Oh, God. I have to think this is going to be where they're going to say we're going to put Android on Chrome OS, right?
Yeah, there's a couple things they could do. I mean, there's the rumored desktop operating system that we may or may not hear about. There's getting Android apps on Chrome OS, which kind of works now, but there was code somebody found where it said Google Play was going to end up on Chrome OS, so you'd get like the whole App Store and be able to pick from whatever you want, which would be crazy. Because if that works, then it's because of the kind of technical underpinnings of it. It would be very easy to make that work on Windows and Mac and Linux since it's just a Chrome extension. So you'd have Google's App Store on like all these desktop operating systems. It would be super crazy.
So you're saying if Google went to the effort to put Android, the Play Store, on a Chromebook, they would, as a benefit, be able to put it on everything else that has Chrome on it?
Yeah, because you can do this right now. You can run individual Android apps on Chrome OS, and it all works through a project called Arc. It's the app runtime for Chrome, and this is built on the Chrome extension platform. Oh,
so it's not using any Chrome OS underpinnings. It's just using Chrome.
Right, yeah. It's just a Chrome extension, and because it's a Chrome extension, it works on Chrome OS and Windows and Mac and Linux. And they've kind of been building the technical part of this for like 4 or 5 years. It's been called Native Client. And now it seems like they're finally going to unleash the potential of this and have like this crazy hostile ecosystem takeover.
That's kind of interesting.
That would be really interesting.
Maybe I picked the wrong time to put Linux on my Chromebook Pixel. Whoops. I had kind of given up on the Chromebook Pixel, and I thought, well, there are other really now better and faster Chromebooks out there. The Dell and the HP and the Acer are all beautiful, all aluminum and less expensive. So, and I'd been waiting for kind of something to happen with putting a Linux shell on Chrome OS. You know, there's Crouton, but that's not really very happy. So I just put Debian on it. It actually works great. There were a few things I had to do. But that's really interesting. How about the Pixel C tablet? Will that go the other way? Will that's an Android device that really could have been a Chrome OS device.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of seeing the beginnings of that in Android N, where there's a split screen mode. There's also a floating like multi-window mode in Android that we found a bit ago. So we'll probably hear about that. That's not like officially released yet, but through the usual weird hacking, we were able to enable it. So I don't know that. I mean, you're definitely going to see Android go the other way, where you'll get more and more kind of desktop operating system features like a window system. But the Pixel C doesn't have a mouse, so you're kind of stuck with just split screen on that. It's really limited.
You wrote a great article on the Pixel C and how it was really an orphan product that was intended for other uses, and they finally just pushed it out the door with not the right OS, and it's kind of a mess.
Yeah, it's a weird product. If they held it past the release of Android N, I think their reception for it would be a lot better, because then you get split screen and it becomes a little more useful. It's just weird. It was supposed to have Chrome OS and would make more sense with that, I think.
Yeah. So this could be, frankly, I think Chrome OS is getting better and better and more desirable. And now that there are many, it's really interesting to see all these former Windows, or I guess continuing to be Windows OEMs, hedge their bets with Windows and make pretty darn nice Chrome OS devices in a broad range of prices. And
what was it? That aluminum HP Chromebook?
Makes it beautiful.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really nice looking.
Acer also has an aluminum one. And Dell, both HP, Dell, and Acer all have what I've been wanting for a long time. A lot of Chromebooks are the cheap $200 netbooky kind of devices, very plasticky, which is fine. I mean, there's a market for that. But I wanted to see something in the mid-range, the $500 to $600 range, that was a nicer device. Not as expensive as the Pixel, which is really ridiculous. Nobody's going to spend $1,200 on a Chromebook. And I think now that there are, I think Dell, HP, Acer, Asus, and Lenovo are all making very nice Chromebooks. Samsung, too. I should throw them in.
Yep.
And so that's a and of course, the thing that people don't like about Chromebooks is they feel, foolishly, I believe, feel they need like a more complete operating system. They want more apps. They want a file system. They all this stuff that they, trust me, they don't really want. But a good way to do it would be to add Android, right?
Well, then you're going to get a lot of phone apps, and it's not, I don't know that it's going to fix Chrome OS all that much. I kind of feel like Google Play on Chrome OS is just kind of the safe test area where they launch this. And then the real target, I think, is Google Play on Windows and Mac OS.
Because
it doesn't add a ton to Chrome OS. I mean, like, my personal problem with Chrome OS is you can't get, like, a good photo editor. And I want these big, powerful desktop apps, not little phone apps.
Well, but there's also an issue there because you don't have a lot of storage on Chrome OS. You know, none of the Chromebooks really come with more than 32 gigs of storage.
Yeah, you were saying your Pixel's, what, $1,200 and has 32 gigs of storage?
I mean, in every respect, it's an i7, it's 8 gigs of RAM, it's a wonderful computer. I love the keyboard. The 3.2 touchscreen is beautiful. So in every respect, it's a great computer, but it doesn't have much storage because it's a Chromebook. and it, God, if it had 64 gigs or better, 128 gigs. On the other hand, it's funny how spoiled we are because, I mean, Matthew, you and I are old enough to remember when PCs came with much smaller hard drives. And we were
250
fine.
Megs.
Yeah, and we were fine. I remember my first 2-gig hard drive. I thought, oh, I'll never run out of space on this. So 32 gigs, well, it doesn't sound like a lot.
And I mean, you can buy a USB, a 64-gig USB drive for $20.
This has an SD card slot, which a lot of Chromebooks don't. So that means I could put a 200-gig SD card in there, and there you go.
There you go.
That's the storage I need. So I have to say, you think, Ron, is it time for another Pixel? Do you think they might show a new Chromebook hardware?
No, we would hear about it.
We would know.
Chromebook hardware ends up in the Chromium source repository, so it's not. Mm. It's usually never a surprise.
Okay.
The guys that pay attention to this are like, there's a new board found in the thing, and it'll be named after like a Street Fighter character or something, and and then everybody knows some kind of Pixel is coming.
Right.
But there's none of that yet.
Maybe they're just happy enough that the other guys are doing them; they don't need to do them anymore.
I just saw something about Google working on something similar to Amazon's Echo.
Oh, I'd love to see that. I mean, Google, it's baffled me with the Echo that Google and that Google and Apple and Microsoft have not done something similar. The Echo is really kind of it's a unique device. And
so according to Recode, they're working on something that'll look sort of like the OnHub wireless router and goes by the name Chirp. Or that's the internal name.
Yeah, I've heard that before, yeah.
Have you?
Yeah, I've heard somebody say Chirp before as their little voice appliance. It makes a ton of sense because Google already has all the parts and
the software.
And the nice thing about the Echo though is because it's plugged in, the voice hot word is like a million times better than what you get on a smartphone. Because smartphones are always trying to fall asleep and save power, and this thing, when it has electricity, it can just have the mic on full blast all the time.
Yeah, that's
awesome.
A good point.
And brilliantly done mics. The Array mics are much better because they pick up every sound in the room. In fact, we have an Echo now. I've stopped counting. I have a lot of Echoes. A bedroom, living room, kitchen, den. Anyway, I have one in the kitchen, and I say, Echo set timer for 4 minutes, and it will respond, and the one in the gym will respond, and it's pretty far away. And so they really are good. In that respect, it's kind of funny to have dueling Echoes. So that's part of it. Now, didn't the On Hub? It doesn't have a microphone. It did have a speaker. You did not like the or were underwhelmed by the On Hub run. In fact, I didn't buy it because of you.
Yeah, good call. The on-hub still sucks. There's still none of that ever actually happened. Like, it was supposed to be a smart home device and has all these sensors in it or has all these antennas in it that are dormant and are supposed to work. But no, it still doesn't work. The USB port still doesn't work. Bluetooth still doesn't work.
The one thing they added was this, then that.
Right. And so you get smart home stuff through somebody else's ecosystem.
Yeah.
Not Google actually doing what they promised they were going to do. So, yeah, it's a huge bummer.
Seems like a real missed opportunity. I mean, when I saw it, I thought, oh, that's great. It could be a smart home hub. You know, Google's got lots of services that could integrate with that.
Yeah. The actual story about the Chirp comes from Jessica Lessons, The Information, read Albergati reporting. Apparently there are four Nest Google products under wraps. One is called Flintstone. I'll buy it just for the name. Note, imagine a tech company naming a product after America's Stone Age family.
Yeah.
Well, I like the nickname for that because the engineers think it's never going to come out, so they nicknamed it Tombstone.
Oh,
instead.
Ow! Well, Nest has been working on it for 3 years, so maybe not. That's a wireless hub in the brains of a Nest security system. I can guarantee you it's dead now. After the reports, and we talked about it yesterday on Security Now, that Zigbee is a terrible idea for a security system because you can jam it. And anybody with a $2 jammer just walks in the door and the security system doesn't know they're there. And it's just there.
What gets me about Alexa is you can say, like, you know, Alexa, unlock the doors or something and it'll do it. And it's like, what if someone's just outside your house and screams
shouts
that
it
really loud? Yeah,
this is a bad idea.
I mean,
we need to rethink the idea of security systems being tied to this infrastructure.
Yeah.
Security systems should be secure, seems to me. They're also working on something called Pinna, which is a wireless security sensor. Fancier, though, than the existing stuff. Both of these will use Thread, which is the Internet of Things OS or communications protocol, I should say.
It's like a Wi-Fi replacement kind of thing.
And then Keshi, not Kesha, Keshi. These are mobile Bluetooth tags, kind of like the tracker. Mm-hmm. Also using Thread, could operate like a smart key fob. Again, I really worry about wireless systems that unlock doors. And then finally, this Chirp thing.
Yeah, but Nest is a disaster. So anything you hear about future Nest products coming out, don't hold your breath. Because, I mean, these guys have been inside Alphabet for, I don't know, what is it, a couple years now? And have released no new products. They bought Dropcam and rebranded it, and that's kind of been there. They got all this money from Alphabet and have done not a whole lot with it. It's just... There's
well, it's
been
interesting
stories
that
on...
the Recode piece said that originally Nest was going to work on this thing that was
rebuffed.
The Echo. Yeah, and then Google's like, that's not happening.
This is from The Information. Google is working on a device to compete directly with Amazon's popular Echo voice control personal assistant portable speaker. Nest wanted to be part of the project within Google, but was rebuffed by the person in charge of Google's project.
Nice.
Google already employs technology like the Echo and Android, of course. You know what I just got and I really like? I haven't done a review of it yet, is the Echo Dot. So this is the little, it's the tiny part. It's just like
the
if you cut
one,
the top part off the Echo. It's got a little speaker, but it's not intended to be used as a speaker. It's just the array mics and the smarts of the Echo, and then you pair it or connect it physically to whatever speakers you want. And that was always my... One knock on the Echo was it didn't have a great speaker in it. So it's fine for audible books, but it wasn't great for music. So now I have it hooked up to a very nice speaker system, and I'm happy. I'm loving it.
So for me, the reason I'm looking forward to a Google voice appliance thing is that my problem with the Echo was that the ecosystem around it really wasn't great. Like everything... Mm-hmm. wanted to be locked into the Alexa app. Like you say, you know, add this to my shopping list and it sticks it inside the Alexa app and you make a to-do thing and that goes in the Alexa app. Like I want you to use the apps that I prefer on my smartphone and on the internet and all that. Like, I don't want to live my life inside of your one app, because that's like what most of the Alexa functions go to, and you can't change them.
Right.
And yeah, it's a huge bummer.
It's the same reason I haven't been in that interested, is exactly that. I'd much rather have something that moved across different platforms and ecosystems.
You can make
web.
Appointments on your Google Calendar now, though. They just added that.
So there's that.
There's that. I think the thing that's interesting with the Echo is the skills. It's fairly easy to write skills. So it isn't that, I mean, Echo is extensible to work with any app. All the app developer would do would have to write an Echo skill.
What's a skill?
So it's very easy to write these. Amazon provides the infrastructure. You use Amazon's own servers. There, you can write one for free, or you can pay per transaction. And it's a very simple thing to add a skill to the Echo. Now, the problem with it is it's kind of a silo. So you have to know, and there are hundreds of skills now. You have to go to the Alexa app, search for the right skill, and add it. You have to enable it. And then you have to remember that you did it. So
it's like there, if this, then that.
It's very extensible, though. I mean,
yeah, it's an API.
It's a great API. So there's no reason why you couldn't, you know, if you're a calendar app, for instance, have an Echo skill that would work. Hmm. You know, I play Jeopardy with my Echo. I say, Echo, ask, you know, let's play Jeopardy. And it gives me 6 Jeopardy questions. It's tied to the Jeopardy app. It even does a plug for the Jeopardy app. It says,
that's cool.
Yeah. So I feel like it's an open ecosystem, but it's difficult to manage at this point because the vocabulary is all over the place. You know, it's very hard to know what your Echo can or cannot do.
Yeah, but the Echo is like a good year old, I think, and I tried it a few weeks ago, and there's still that skill ecosystem never turned into being able to do what I want with it. Really, it's just not very popular with developers, I would guess.
It's easy to write, so if you're a Pythonista, it's not hard. There's 87 pages there of skills.
You can use it to pull your Tesla out of the garage, apparently.
You can. Somebody autos. Yes. So Tesla added a summon feature, which makes me extremely nervous. You'd also have to tie it to your garage door opener.
Yeah.
So, but I'm sure you could do that with if this, then that. And the proper garage door equipage. And the car would pull out of the garage without a driver in there. It does it very slowly so as not to run into anything.
I hope so.
Yeah.
You'll only be slowly run over by your vehicle.
Well, I just saw something. Someone used summon and smashed the car up, I think.
Yeah, you can't. So you're relying on the Tesla's sensors to see everything. And it's always been the case that they don't see everything. It even says that in the manual very clearly. You know, don't trust these sensors. So summon, it's more of a nice idea.
Yeah, this guy in Utah is... Yeah. Car crashed into a parked trailer.
Nice. At a very low rate of speed, probably. Like 2 miles an hour. But, you know, you hit something with a 2-ton car, it doesn't really matter. There you go. See how slow it is? This is a video of it parking.
That is slow.
Yeah, no, it really is inching in there. And that makes you feel a little bit better. But that's because it has to see all the stuff and know when to stop, know when to stop, know when to stop. Oh, I guess it's going all the way.
So Tesla, it's interesting. They have so much detail in the driver logs. In this case, they're quoting from the logs.
Oh, yeah, by the way.
Show that summon was initiated by a double press of the gear selector stock button.
Yeah, you don't own those logs.
No, of course not. Driver was alerted with an audible chime and a pop-up message.
And ignored it, Raleigh, right?
Ignored the cancel.
Yeah.
Wow.
They did change how summon worked to make the make it more. Was it dead man switch? Yeah, no, they know a lot.
Brake pedal was released. 2 seconds later, the driver exited the vehicle. 3 seconds after that, the driver's door was closed. 3 seconds later, summon activated pursuant to the driver's double press activation request.
Yeah. Is that wild?
Amazing.
You broke all the rules, and Elon doesn't mind telling you. The warnings were not heeded.
6 seconds later, driver puts his arm out the window, waves to a passerby.
I have to say,
that's good though. They knew the ambulance chasers would be after him. Second, they had any kind of car auto driving stuff.
Yep.
So yeah.
I have a Tesla in order. It's going to come in the fall, Model X. And
which one? X?
Yeah. Mm. And I think that you just, that's the price you pay to be a Tesla owner, is that Elon is always watching.
Oh, yeah.
And I will be, you probably won't hear me do a lot of talking about this thing. I don't want to get in trouble.
He'll take it back.
Yeah, here's your check. Give me the car.
Didn't he refuse someone?
He did.
Someone criticized that.
Stuart Alsop.
He rejected his order.
Great tech reporter, old friend.
No, you can't have a Tesla.
He was bitching because he went to the event.
Oh, right.
And he had to wait 3 hours, didn't see the car. And he blogged about it on Medium. And Elon said, fine.
No Tesla for you.
Fine. And so I really want one. So you have to really want one. I really want one, and I'm willing to surrender all privileges to own one.
Everything.
You can log everything I'm doing. What else? Google I.O. So you really think they're going to be all in on VR and AR. They have a big investment in Leap Motion, right? Or Magic Leap.
Leap? Oh, yeah. Magic Leap.
That's Leap Motion's
different.
For a
million years. Don't worry about that.
We're not going to see anything for Magic Leap.
No. The big deal is going to be Project Tango, which is they're going to have the first consumer Project Tango device built by Lenovo. So this is going to be a smartphone with a bunch of sensors on the back, kind of like a Microsoft Kinect, where it'll have it'll be like 3D computer vision. So you'll be able to take it and like pan it around a room, and it'll scan the room and give you kind of a 3D model of it. And they want to use this for stuff like gaming, where, you know, there could be little gnomes running around on the floor, and you could kind of lower your phone and zoom into whatever's happening in the virtual world. Or precise indoor mapping. So when you can 3D scan a room, you know exactly where you are in the room. So, you know, Google Maps could take you from, you know, the door of the airport into the airport over to your flight gate.
This has never felt like a consumer product to me. I could see why you'd want it if you had a business and you wanted to have a floor plan in the Google Maps. But why would what is the consumer side of this?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it would be, I guess, like a gaming console kind of thing.
But it's not a VR, I mean, or an AR headset. It would be a part of it, of an overall AR experience, but they don't have the rest of the parts, right? They just map the room. There's no gnome part. Or is there? Maybe they'll show
that. There's no headset, I mean, but it would still be augmented reality just through kind of an LCD screen. Like, you wouldn't attach it to your face or anything, but that still counts as augmented reality, where you kind of, you scan a room and like place people in it or you know, characters in 3D. And I mean, people who have been using them as robot heads, since it kind of has all that scanning stuff and has a...
Yeah. No, I could see how you... So display. That's what it feels like to me, something you might use for something else.
I don't get the consumer pitch. Yeah. I mean, with all of this crazy camera gear and 3D processing and all that, the battery life has got to be like horrible. Right. You wouldn't want to use it as a day-to-day smartphone.
There have been Tango tablets out for a while, and I think there's a developer kit. It's a specialty product, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get it. I mean, yeah, here's for sales in a house.
Great for that.
Yeah, there's like a Lowe's app where you can like visualize the dishwasher in your house.
There aren't that many realtors out there who are going to actually do this. Maybe if it's a Sotheby's $8 million home, you want an online catalog.
Yeah, but I mean, as the first ever consumer version, that's kind of their job to give us the sales pitch. Right. So who knows?
I feel like if you care that much, you're going to go see the house. I mean, okay, this is, yeah, all right. Apparently, they're going to do an Android, standalone Android VR headset. This is not cardboard. Peter Rojas tweeted that Android VR will launch as a dedicated standalone handset.
Yeah, that's a weird report because Android is an operating system, so they wouldn't call the hardware Android VR. But he says, yeah, that some kind of hardware is going to launch. It can't be called Android.
Sounds like gear, though, unless it's... Mm-hmm. Unless, so right now, if you have cardboard or gear, you have to have a phone that you insert in the thing. So the cardboard's cheap because it's a holder is all it is with some lenses. But, of course, if you didn't have a phone or you didn't have appropriate phone, I guess if you would spend a few $100, you could have cardboard with a built-in hardware.
Yeah, so the full collection of rumors is that they're going to have a Gear VR competitor, and then they're going to make a standalone headset with the processor and screen and all that in it. And they're going to have an Android version of a version of Android built for virtual reality, which I think would be the most important part, because all of these, you know, there's already a million headsets out there. The Gear VR already exists, but Android built for virtual reality would be like the first ever VR operating system. Like, you know, there's lots of people have Vives and Oculus Rifts and all that stuff, but all they do on them is play games. Nobody's really tried a like menu systems and email and all this stuff in 3D virtual reality all over the place, which sounds super interesting.
I would also imagine we'll see some Android TV stuff, or no? Android Wear?
Nothing. There's been nothing serious for Android TV. I don't think they've been talking to the FCC about getting access to cable boxes so that you wouldn't have to get a cable box from your cable company and could buy one with maybe Android TV on it or something. It has been a very long time since we've heard anything from the Android Wear people. There's no rumors or anything, but it's been like a year maybe since they had a serious operating system upgrade.
Yeah.
And all the watches are pretty old.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a good bet.
Or not. Or it died. I remember, Android TV starting to feel like Google TV, which just kind of died on the vine.
Died.
Are you a fan?
Which is too bad.
Matthew?
Well, I wanted to be a fan. I mean, I was looking for basically an alternative to Apple TV.
Right.
And I thought, geez, if Android TV works good or Google TV, it just nothing has ever seemed to. I mean, you can get.
I have the Shield, the NVIDIA Shield.
Yeah. You like it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except that, it's just unrealized potential. It's huge unrealized potential. It should be better than the Amazon Fire TV or the Apple TV, except nobody's doing anything. It's very disappointing.
Is anybody doing anything with any of the TV platforms, though? I mean, it's all just kind
of,
you can
slowly
play Netflix on this.
Yeah, they're all moving fairly slowly. I think everybody is hoping and waiting for an over-the-top solution. You know, we're waiting for the FCC in the U.S. anyway, for the FCC to mandate an open standard for set-top boxes. Right now, you have to get it from the cable company.
Yeah.
Or, as I do, I use a TiVo, and then the cable company has to give you a cable card. But the FCC has proposed rules that would require an open set-top box system.
It sounds like that's coming. So I imagine everyone's sort of waiting. Like, why pour a bunch of money into it if the whole landscape's going to shift soon?
Right. And, of course, the other side of that equation is getting the cable companies and the networks, which are sometimes the same thing, at least in the case of Comcast and NBC, to give us some sort of over-the-top experience. Or Apple's been trying for years to do this. The rumor was who was it? Who's the latest one that was about to make a deal? YouTube Unplugged.
Yeah, YouTube Unplugged.
Yeah.
Well, and I wrote about that. I don't know if – I'm sure Ron has – thoughts as well, but we've heard, how long has Google been talking about how long have there been since 2012, as far as I can remember. Apple's been talking about it since 2009, and it just never seems to happen. And what it feels to me, at least, like one of the sticking points is every time these guys get together, Google and Apple say, so here's what we want all your stuff, all the best channels, and here's the price we want, because we want to basically offer it for like $30 a month or less. And then all of the cable, all the TV providers and content companies are like, well, that's not going to happen, because we want you to pay us, X amount for this channel and X amount for that channel. And pretty soon it's $75 a month.
Right.
And so then they just say, well, let's talk again,
That's the problem. They're not getting a hard no. If they're getting a hard no, if they said, you nuts, get out of here. Go, get out. But they're not. They're saying, well, no, you know, it's an interesting idea. We maybe, you know, I like that idea. Let's see if we could let's crunch those numbers some more.
Right, exactly. So they go away. So Disney and CBS and, you know, Viacom and everything, they don't want to say a hard no because I think they're terrified.
Well, they are. They know that they're in trouble.
Yeah, they know they're in trouble and they're losing sort of power by the day.
Right.
And so part of them wants to cut a deal.
They haven't hit bottom
yet.
They just can't
stomach the price, right? Right. They just can't, because the finance guys are like, are you joking? We can't give it to Apple and Google for that.
Well, if put yourself in the position of an NBC or a Comcast, for that matter. You know, everybody under 25, nobody under 25 watches TV. They watch YouTube. So they see this train hurtling down the track at mm-hmm. them, but they're playing a game of chicken. I'm not going to jump. I can get another year out. It's like the music industry, they kind of did the same thing.
It is. It's very similar. And they can't. So the same way the music industry tried to charge exactly the same for digital files as they did for CDs to sort of prop up the CD business, cable companies and TV providers want exactly the same amount of money
right.
from Apple and Google or more as they charge out all the satellite and cable guys.
But meanwhile, what Comcast has been doing is a backfill operation where they slowly increase the cost of internet because they want
to. So cable companies get to do that.
Yeah.
They get to hose mm-hmm. you on cable right. as well. Although they can't do caps. That's one interesting feature of, so the FCC has basically said bandwidth caps
right.
are not kosher.
Right.
Not officially.
Well, it's anti-competitive because if you're Comcast, you really don't want people to be watching HBO now because
right.
you don't get any money for that because that's coming in over the internet. You want them to be watching HBO on the television because you get paid monthly for that. So,
but you see, everybody's
they see it
making
coming.
These,
they know it's coming.
So oh, yeah. No, they know it's coming.
Yeah.
And they're all making these sort of side deals. So, you know, Disney will cut a deal with Sling TV and cut a deal with Sony for the PlayStation View. But Apple and Google are so huge. You know, they're not, like Sling TV is still a relatively small thing. But if you suddenly cut some cozy deal with Google or Apple,
yeah.
you know, all hell's going to break loose.
The record industry, the guys, you know, the guy in the white pants from Capitol's calling the guy at NBC Universal saying, hey, we did this deal with Apple, and you saw what happened. It was terrible. iTunes and it is alive, so stay away. Those guys, they'll kill you. Oh, yeah, they say they're just a small computer company, but they're not a small computer company. They're going to kill you. Take it from me. I'm on my fifth heart attack.
I think Columbo works
for the music industry.
I think if this FCC thing does take off and they kind of open up cable boxes, then I think Android TV gets a lot better.
I hope
since everybody I needs so. A DVR anyway for TV.
Right.
Yeah. So you might as well get one with Android TV on it and has all these apps and can run Netflix and all that. But right now, having it as a standalone box is kind of like
I hardly ever launch it. It's got so much potential. Yeah. I hardly ever launch it.
Just imagine, like, if you did have a set-top box that was open in some way.
Oh, man.
Like, even the crappiest version of an Android box that you can buy from some guy off Craigslist who set up all the channels for you or whatever, like, is 10 times better than your cable box.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. These cable boxes are horrible. I'm slowly replacing Comcast's top-of-the-line product, the X1, which they really are selling as, like, a digital mm-hmm. solution. It's so just god-awful that I'm slowly replacing them with TiVos. But TiVos are not a great solution either because they're incredibly expensive. You have to buy the TiVo, and then you have to buy the subscription, and it ends up being very pricey alternative. And you still have to rent a cable card from Comcast, so they get you anyway. But then they really screw you. This is the thing that gets me. So TiVo has HBO Go on it, but you can't sign up through Comcast because they block it. They did that to Roku for a long time.
Yep.
They did that to Roku. Only recently could you use your, if you were a Comcast customer, could you use HBO Go. You have to, but you know, it's just, ay. It's tough to be a cord cutter, but the problem is what's going to happen is, you know, we still want to see our shows.
Mm-hmm.
The younger generation, they don't care.
No.
You got nothing I want, so see ya. I got my laptop or my tablet, and that's fine with me. My phone. Let's take a break. We're having fun. Ron Amadio's here from Ars Technica. He's going to be at Google I.O. next week. We'll check in with you, find out if how much of this came true. We're going to be doing lots of coverage.
Yeah, you get to hold my feet to the fire.
Yeah. Ron!
See what happens.
You didn't tell us about the parachuting nanobots.
Yeah.
What are you, not paying attention? Also, Matthew Ingram from Fortune.com. He doesn't have to worry about that kind of stuff. He's a big thinker. Don't get
medium-sized thinker.
Don't ever get in the prognostication business. It's a no-win. No win. Our show today brought to you, we got a new sponsor. I love these guys. Ministry of Supply. I was telling you before the show, I didn't even know they were going to be a sponsor, and I went out and bought some great stuff. My new shorts, Ministry of Supply, they make stuff that's for people like us that's long-lasting, smart clothing. And they do things like if you were going to rethink clothing, so for instance, instead of having buttons, have these little snap things, and it's great. They're so much better than buttons. They're faster and easier to use, and they hold on better. I got some Ministry of Supply clothes here. I just love it. Go to ministryofsupply.com/twig. You'll get 15% off your first purchase with the code twig. I also got a travel jacket from them. The whole idea is it's stylish, good-looking, long-wearing clothes for smart people. And this stuff is business clothes that are engineered by MIT-trained engineers to provide technical things. Body temperature regulation keeps you from getting too hot or too cold. Moisture-wicking fibers. They're stretched. I love these. Those are the shorts I got. Best shorts I've ever had. Incredible. Some Gemini chinos. This is a classic twill chino, but they re-engineered it using phase change materials from NASA. It stores and releases body heat based on the surrounding climate. It's cotton with these phase change materials built in. And the fibers are stretchy, so you can bend and sit without any restriction. It's clothes like you want to wear that if you thought, oh, I think we can reinvent clothing, this is it. Ministry of Supply. Oh, this is a nice shirt. There's a shirt for you. Nice collar. I mean, they are stylish, right? But it's really a work wardrobe workhorse. The material wicks sweat from your skin with laser cut ventilation and underarms to keep the airflow going. Stretchy material allows great movement. The brushed interior it feels different on the inside than it does on the outside. It's really soft. Here's the archive. This is the archive shirt. All their clothes are easy to maintain, wrinkle resistant. That's one of the reasons I got them, because they're wash and dry. Great for traveling. You never need to iron them. They're great for geeks. Look at that. And they look good. They really do. MinistryofSupply.com/twig. 15% off your first purchase. They also have stores. Boston, San Francisco, Washington, D.C. is opening too. So if you go to the store, just mention Twig, and you get 15% in the store too. This is smarter menswear straight out of MIT. Finally, somebody's designing clothes by us, for us. MinistryofSupply.com/twig. Oh, this is a Mercury SVK sweater. So it's Merino wool, but also has this PCM-infused acrylic. And get this. This is 28% carbonized coffee-infused nylon. Doesn't smell like coffee, but the coffee infusion, it reduces odors. What? This is awesome stuff. Yeah, it doesn't smell like coffee, but it's beautifully soft and nice. Oh, I'm going to wear this right now. Sorry, you're going to lose your sample. This is mine. I'm taking it. MinistryofSupply.com/twig. Oh, that's nice, though. It's so nice. Clothing for geeks by geeks. Matthew Ingram is here from Fortune.com. Mr. Ron Amadio from Ars Technica. Today, day two, Oracle versus Google, the smackdown in downtown. this is a trial that never will end, of course. Google, and I remember talking to James Gosling, the inventor of Java, a few weeks ago on triangulation. And he says, Sun invented Java. James Gosling was at Sun when he invented Java. And then, of course, Google went to Sun and said, we'd like to license Java. We'd like to use Java for Android. Actually, it wasn't even Google at the time. I think it was Andy Rubin at Android. Google later acquired them. And for whatever reason, they didn't end up licensing it. They created, an equivalent, a JVM called Dalvik. Right, Ron? Dalvik.
Yes.
And now they're using Art.
Yeah.
But Dalvik is API identical to Java. Now, I have to say, Gosling said, we looked at the Dalvik code, and it was our opinion at Sun that they had actually copied some of the code. This was our code we saw in there. So he said Google slimed us, but not to the point where we were going to sue him. We didn't want to sue Google, so we just left it. But he says during the conversations between Oracle and Sun, during the acquisition talks, he says the Oracle lawyer's eyes lit up when we started talking about Java. They knew there was something there, and Oracle was perfectly willing to go after Google. And in fact, they did. They sued, saying, and this is the interesting thing, and this is where Gosling said, this is where I think there was some merit in this, but their lawyers, the Oracle lawyers, determined that we're not going to get them on the stealing code stuff. It's too arcane. No jury will get it. We're going to get them on the APIs are copyrightable. They stole the API. Now, by the way, there'd be no PC industry if Compaq couldn't copy IBM's BIOS API in a clean room environment. They didn't steal the code. They just made it functionally equivalent. There would be no PC industry if that hadn't happened, if that had been illegal. Initially, this was thrown out. The court and even the appeals court said no, but somehow this has gotten back into trial. Now they're having a jury trial. And Oracle is suing for $9 billion. They're suing Google, saying Google's use of Java APIs violates copyright law. Former Sun CEO, the final CEO, the last guy, the man who sold Sun to Oracle, testified today, took the stand today. Was the Java language created by Sun in the 90s free and open to use? The Google lawyer asked. Absolutely yes, Jonathan Swartz said. Since its inception, long before I arrived at Sun. It was in our interest to promote the use of Java everywhere. If you were using Java, then everything else Sun sold, we could sell it to you. If you were using Windows, which is the dominant or was the dominant operating system, we had nothing to sell you. Schwartz said that freedom extended the use of Java APIs as well. See, I don't think Schwartz was real happy with Larry Ellison and Oracle.
No one's happy with Larry Ellison.
Yeah, who is? The strategy is, this is Schwartz talking. We agree on these open APIs, then we compete on implementation.
Mm-hmm. The whole idea of copyrightability for APIs, like, and using copyright law to pursue people who use an API, I think that the implications of that are kind of disturbing.
It's messed up. And if they win, it's a very bad thing. Schwartz says the strategy was, we agree, okay. The open strategy sometimes led to things Schwartz doesn't like the GNU ClassPath project, an open source Java product that Sun was forced to compete with. Did they take a license? Asked Google's lawyer. No, absolutely not, Schwartz answered. I was annoyed, but it was completely consistent with our practices. When you say APIs are open, they're going to be competitive implementations. Apache Harmony. He says there was nothing we could do about it. Schwartz, when he was CEO, had discussions with Eric Schmidt about a possible partnership in the mobile space. Sun was looking for Google to promote the brand, to endorse Java and endorse that logo. That would mean a lot of other companies would want to pick up Sun products. It would make Sun more relevant in the marketplace. They didn't make a deal. I think it was a combination of money and technical independence, says Schwartz. Google didn't want to rely on anyone else.
Yeah, it sounds more like that to me.
Sun also
to do their own stuff.
Part of the big difference at the time was that Google needed to strip down everything to get this to run on a smartphone. Because smartphones back then were unbelievably slow. So they, you know, it wasn't just the Java APIs. Like, they had to hack and slash away at everything that was unnecessary in order to get some kind of working operating system up on this. And at the time, it seemed like they were doing everything above board. You know, they had a they did a clean room implementation of the APIs, and the CEO of Sun posted like a congratulatory blog post when the Google deal was announced. And now Oracle comes along and says, oh, well, we own this now, and we're going to sue the crap out of you. And
which is totally Oracle, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's so Oracle. Okay, so apparently Schwartz is testifying for Google, even though he was the Sun CEO. Now Oracle's lawyer gets cross-examination. He asks, you didn't want to work for Oracle, did you? Schwartz, no, I did not. Oracle didn't offer you any senior management position, did they? No. Mm-hmm. By the way, I should really point out, this is a jury trial. So you've got 12 people who have no freaking clue what an API is, guarantee you. In fact, there was only one person with any development or technology experience, and Oracle got him off the jury. So that's these crazy. Are 12 people who know nothing.
Right.
They're off the street. So
they don't know anything about technology.
Right.
They don't know anything about APIs. They don't know anything about probably about copyright law either.
Right. These are 12 of your peers. Oracle didn't offer you a position, did they? No, I resigned. Was Oracle frustrated at your guidance? Oracle was frustrated with the speed at which customers began abandoning Sun once it became clear we were going to be acquired by Oracle. So they're trying to basically say, oh, Schwartz, you hate Oracle, and that's why you're testifying against us. And, of course, this is not about technology. This has nothing to do with APIs and whether they should be copyrightable. Because the jury won't understand that anyway.
No. It's about $9 billion in damages.
Who cares if Google has to pay $9 billion? That's not what worries me. What worries me is there's precedent that APIs are copyrighted.
It's the principle.
Mm-hmm. Bad idea. And even James Gosling said that would be a terrible, terrible precedent to set. Well, we'll follow. This is going to continue on, okay? Yeah.
Yeah. Our guy in the courtroom, Joe, has been crazy. He posted, I think, like 4 or 5 stories.
Yeah, this is Joe's. By the way, I should have given Joe Mullen credit here. This is his. This is from his transcript at Ars Technica. He's done a great job on this. By the way, at the end it says, highly recommend you just follow Joe and Ars Technica and just read these articles because this is fascinating stuff and very important. So finally, in the midst of the greatest recession, you were one of the bottom 10 CEOs in the country, according to the employees, says Oracle's lawyer. 10, 15 worst CEOs in American history.
Ouch.
And Schwartz says, in the midst of the greatest recession of my lifetime, a lot of people were upset. I was upset, too. Anyway, this is good. Highly recommend it. And it's an important trial, not because of $9 billion, but because of the precedent it might set.
And unfortunately, the Supreme Court has already ruled that API use can't fall under fair use.
Right.
So you can't claim
fair use. So that's kind of, and that was related to this. So what happened was Oracle lost in the appeals court. So they took it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court didn't rule on it. They just turned it back. And that's why we're having a jury trial now. By the way, only 10 people on the jury, not 12, sorry. Mm. How long is this supposed to go on? Do you know, Ron? How long will Joe be stuck in there?
No idea. I don't know if he knows, really. I have no idea.
Yeah.
All of this court stuff, it just goes on forever and ever, and there's appeals and more appeals, and I don't know. I let Joe take care of all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think this one is kind of interesting. And, of course, this would be a terrible, terrible precedent to set. We'll continue to follow it. With interest, not because of Google, but as much as just because this is something that affects everything. It's like the Feinstein-Burr encryption bill, which would effectively make browsers illegal. Just a little thing, not a big deal. Or actually, we'd make SSL illegal. I guess you could still have a browser. Mm-hmm. You just couldn't have a secure browser. There's nothing wrong with that. That couldn't have any consequences. People should be able to bank without security. No problem. What else? We did Chirp. We did Nest. What is going on at Nest, Ron? Are they going to just fold their 10 eventually?
Seems like a train wreck.
I had Nest thermostats installed, and when we moved, I didn't bother reinstalling them. It was like, eh. I even own them, and it was like, eh.
Yeah, the Nest really bummed me out when I got one. But maybe months ago, they finally added GPS via your cell phone to turn the heater on and off.
Oh, that would be good. So as you get closer, you could, yeah.
Yeah, before it was this like one little sensor in the hallway or something, and whenever somebody walks by, it would trip it. But now the app actually uses your phone to know where you are and whether someone's in your house. And turns on and off that way. And that works a lot better.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's just a thermostat, whatever. The interesting thing I had heard about Nest is that it was like a recode report, I think, where they were kind of on like a three-year funding plan at Alphabet. Yeah. And that three-year funding plan is about to run out.
Yeah.
And I think they get to pick, like, if they're going to just spin off Nest and say, goodbye, have fun.
Oh, they could leave Alphabet? Or Alphabet would...
They could get kicked out.
They get kicked out of the Alphabet Club.
I guess, yeah. I mean, Alphabet is a, you know, as a company full of companies, some of these companies are going to fail. And we don't know what happens when that happens. So that will be an interesting thing to see. I don't know.
Google has banned payday loan advertisements, thank goodness, on its AdSense platform. It's about time. This seems the rules aren't too draconian. If your interest rate is 36% or more a year, or you have to pay back in fewer than 2 months, we're not going to do ads for you. I think that's fair.
Do you think so? I don't know.
You're serious?
I'm concerned about. I mean.
I
don't like payday loans.
Okay, this is interesting. No, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
But Google...
They're not illegal.
Right, they're not illegal. So if they were illegal, then obviously Google should not provide advertising for them. But if they're legal and people are choosing to use those services for whatever reason, why should Google not allow them to do that?
Very interesting.
It feels a little bit like... you know, sort of escort ads and those sorts of things. Lots of those things are not technically illegal. Authorities have been trying to get lots of services to not include them, to not. But if it's a legal service, you know, if I'm for whatever reason decide to use that, why shouldn't I be allowed to see ads for that and then choose to do it?
It's a slippery. I see what you're saying, and now I'm coming around to your point of view. Because it's a slippery slope, because this is now Google not merely enforcing the law, but making policy decisions.
Right. And so I think it's fine if we all agree that payday loans are shady. And so
make
we're
them
fine
illegal
with that.
If they're bad.
But, you know, it's like first they came for the payday loan ads and then they came for the thing that I actually like.
Right. Well, related to this, the rumor, and I don't know if it's true, and Facebook denies it, that their editorial team were these temporary curators that Facebook hired were blocking some conservative content from Facebook.
It's interesting. First they denied it, and then they said we're looking into it.
Oh,
so those two things are mutually incompatible,
right?
Like either it didn't happen or you're looking into it. So, and I feel like, you know, definitely there's some pressure. The Senate wants to talk to Facebook about it. They don't actually have, the interesting thing is the Senate, you know, sent a letter and they don't have any right to tell Facebook what to do with its trending topics.
Right. Al Franken is always sending letters out too, right?
Jeff Roberts wrote for us about the First Amendment and how it applies to, you know, algorithms and various other methods through which you do things. That applies to both Google and Facebook. So it's not as though the Senate can say, you know, here's how you have to run your trending topics. But for me, the real issue is everyone got obsessed with the human beings fiddling with things in trending topics. The thing that I find interesting is the algorithm that runs the news feed, which routinely chooses to highlight certain things and not highlight other things.
Right.
Those are all effectively editorial decisions that Facebook is making. And you and I have no clue why they make them. They claim that it's just to serve you and show you things you like. But there are some very real implications around that in terms of people's consumption of the news, the things they see. Facebook chooses to hide, you know, news about Syria or news about attacks on black people or whatever. And so you don't see them because you spend a lot of time on Facebook and it's one of your main sources of news. That has some very, very, I think, fundamental implications for sort of society in general. How do we, and Facebook, my big problem is Facebook kind of pretends that that doesn't happen. So they say, well, it's an algorithm and it just does what you want. The end. That's sort of their standard response.
This is kind of the problem Google's had, though, too, right? Google's also algorithmically generated.
But algorithms are, you know, people.
They're made of
like
people.
Soylent Green, right? Yeah, it's made of people. And so human beings tinker with the algorithm. And if what you have is a lot of, and I'm not saying this specifically about Facebook, but if what you have is a lot of sort of 20-something white guys from Silicon Valley running your algorithm, it's going to make certain decisions, you know, that may or may not be appropriate.
Tom Stocky, go ahead, Ron.
Google search kind of ends up having the same problem a bit because it they personalize your results all the time based on your history and what you've clicked on in the past. And if you go on Google search, there's like a little man and a little world button. And if you click on the world button, it will turn off the personalization, but it kind of ends up building like a bubble around your search results where you know, it only shows you, or it has a bias to show you things you've read in the past. Yeah. So it will block out kind of alternative viewpoints, which is weird. But it's good for some stuff. Cause like I can type in almost anything and it will be related to Android because of my search habits and research and all that. But if you're searching for political stuff or whatever, it's weird and kind of unwanted.
It's actually a little more of an issue with Google. It's easy to adjust the Facebook algorithm. I just ended up following all the candidates, Republican and Democratic, for president, and that really helped create a more broad feed. In fact, one of my friends said, "What are you following, Donald? What, you liked Donald Trump on Facebook?" I said, "Yeah, and so should you, because if you don't want to ignore everything you disagree with, if you should disagree with them."
But lots of people do.
If people do that, they do
that effort. Yeah,
they probably do it in their lives as well.
Filter bubbles were possible before too, right? I mean, we all knew people who only watched one news program or only read one columnist in one right-wing newspaper.
I'm married to the only Republican in Northern California, so I know about filter bubbles, baby.
But with the liking Donald Trump thing, it's like you have to read something first in order to disagree with it. So click the like button, because how else will you know if you hate
something?
And
I follow the libertarian Gary Johnson and everything. I mean, I think it's good to do that, and it broadens you. But people are going to, you know, a lot of people put their finger on both sides. Have put their finger in their ears when somebody says something from the other side. But that's just human. Google can't fix that.
I mean, Facebook has talked in the past about doing research into how the structure of the news feed affects people's political behavior, affects the way they see the world, affects, you know, whether they vote, things like that. There's a huge amount of power when you're as big and influential as Facebook is. And I know, you know, journalist friends have said, well, newspapers and editors make editorial decisions about what to include in their version of the news feed, which is the web page or the website or the newspaper. But there is no newspaper that is as big as Facebook. There is no newspaper on which, you know, 60% of millennials find most of their political news.
Right.
There just simply has never been a media entity like that before.
I've been saying this for years about Google, and I say it now about Facebook, because they both wield immense power. And they are private corporations that aren't required to be balanced and fair in any way, but they have I think there's a higher moral responsibility for both parties.
And the thing is, neither one of them is particular. Google's gotten a lot better. I mean, I think years of criticism of things like Google News they've gotten a lot better. Facebook is still refusing to even have the discussion. So when all this stuff comes up, they just go silent. Or they come out with a statement that says, you know, the algorithm is this magical thing that chooses things based on your behavior, and and we're totally scrupulously fair and objective, or whatever, which just simply can't be true. So I would much rather they at least started having the discussions, started saying, yes, you're right. We are a big media entity. The things we do can have these huge social effects, and so we should talk about that.
Tom Stocky, who is VP of Search at Facebook, posted a couple of days ago, my team is responsible for trending topics, and I want to address the reports about Facebook's contractors manipulating them. By the way, they are anonymous reports, and that, you know, right there. And he writes a nice, I think, piece, and I think it is true that Facebook understands this responsibility, and I mean, at the very least, they don't want to get caught doing it. I don't think they're tempted, though. I think that they understand that their business. He says our review guidelines for trending topics are under constant review. We'll continue to look for improvements. We'll also keep looking into any questions about trending topics to ensure that people are matched. Now, this is where you might get into trouble. Matched with the stories that are predicted to be the most interesting to them. And to be sure that our methods are as neutral and effective as possible. Those seem like contradictory
things. See, those are totally opposite things.
Right.
If it's neutral,
it can't be neutral,
then you can't match it to what someone might want to see.
Right. You might have a problem with that last sentence there. it's a difficult thing to do, but, you know, I think I would not expect Facebook to in any way be trying to manipulate the feed. I mean, you can't imagine somebody sidling up to Mark Zuckerberg
saying,
Mark, what would it take for you to throw presidential.
And I don't think they do that. And I don't think they're deliberately mucking around in things to change people's opinions. In fact, it came up at a Q&A, I think. Facebook employees said, should we be doing something to stop Donald Trump?
Right.
And, you know, everyone said, well, no, that's not what we would do. And that's not part of what we're supposed to do. My problem is that they will sort of accidentally do things that affect the way people vote or when they vote or who they vote for or how they see the world by pursuing their other interests.
Right.
So not deliberately.
Right.
Sort of acts as a secondary effect.
It's an interesting question. Yeah, see, there's an article for Fortune written by a colleague of yours, Ian Mount. Facebook employees, big Hillary Clinton donors. That's neither here nor there. I would hope that their politics would not intrude into their algorithm. Always the potential, though, for unconscious.
Some people pointed out the things that if you look at the things that were removed or that these anonymous sources said were removed from trending topics, it was garbage news reports from right-wing news sites that have no basis in fact. And so I guess it's a little like payday loans. Those are the sort of political reporting version of payday loans. We can all agree, well, that's dumb. You shouldn't include that because it's garbage.
But
what about the next thing?
Right.
Or what about this other link that's slightly more credible?
Who says it's garbage, right?
Right. And
yeah, but also the first report that was like Gizmodo or something, I think, said that they have tools to inject stories artificially into the trending topic thing, which is also crazy because you can influence stuff just as much as you can, you know, adding stuff from removing it.
And they were also prevented from, it's a little like Twitter moments aren't allowed to be about Twitter. So Facebook trending topics at one point were not allowed to be about Facebook.
Because then it would only be about Twitter.
It would all be Twitter. It's a giant echo chamber. Yeah. The problem is it's very hard to watchdog something like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely opaque, both Google's search algorithm and Facebook's trending topics or news algorithm. They're completely open.
And I know there's been, you know, in Google's case, there's been lots of people trying to push for, you know, trying to make search neutrality the same as net neutrality and trying to force Google to basically publicize the algorithm and to, and or to guarantee that they're not going to fiddle with the results. I mean, nobody that I don't think would improve the problem or improve the situation. It might actually make things worse. I it's not that Google and Facebook, you know, part of the value they add is through the selection process. I just think there are implications beyond just, oh, my newsfeed sucks or my search results are terrible. You know, there are implications beyond just the results you're getting, because it does determine, those filter bubbles help shape your worldview to some extent.
We take you now to a Renaissance festival in central Russia, where a drone is shooting imagery of the knights and ladies and lords and a combat scene. That's a drone footage. But notice, nice. One of the knights takes umbrage at this 20th century technology. Uh-oh. And hurls the spear. He takes the drone down. The
nice
drone. The drone is down. The drone. Really nice shot. Look at that.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And give that guy a prize. So now we know. Carry a spear at all times. All right, we're going to take a break. For guys who want a great shave experience at a fraction of the price you'd be paying at the drugstore. Oh, no, I no longer go to CVS to get my $8 blades. I get better blades from Harry's. You know why? Harry's bought the company that makes the blades in Germany, and they've been crafting them. This company's been around for a century. They've been crafting them, and Harry's got them to make the best blades for the best price, and they ship them direct to you, so you don't have to get in line at the drugstore or wait for the clerk to unlock the plexiglass case hiding those super high-priced blades. No, no. A million guys have made the switch to Harry's. Go to the website, harrys.com/twig, and pick up a Harry's today. I am a Winston lover. I get the metal-handled Winston case. It's a Truman kit. The Truman, you know, Steve Gibson's a Truman guy. He likes the kind of the soft touch, grippy surface on the Truman. They got all different colors, too. In every case, these kits come with three blades, your choice of the foaming shave gel or the shave cream. It's shipped to your door, and then you get the blades. You get the subscription of the blades and the cream, so you never run out. I love it. I love it. But we've got a Harry's starter kit you're going to like a lot. This is it, the Truman. $15. Get the handle, the moisturizing shave cream, the three blades. And when you go to harrys.com/twig, they're going to take $5 off that. So that's $10 for all of that. Oh, and don't forget the travel cover, which is a lovely, lovely thing. I'm really a fan of Harry's. I just love everything they do. And the subscription is nice because you always have a fresh blade. So when it is date night and you want to have an extra clean, close shave and a smooth cheek for your honey, go to Harry's, harrys.com/twig. And don't forget to use our special offer to get $5 off the Truman kit. That makes it $10. They have other stuff too. Great gifts for grads. It's that time, isn't it? You got a graduate, high school graduate. Get him a Harry's subscription. It's the gift that keeps on shaving. Samsung Galaxy Note leak from 9 to 5 Google, August 15th. This is the new Note, the 6. I have to say, I have tried all the Android competitors. I don't know what you use, Ron. I'll ask you in a second. I've settled on the Galaxy S7 as my daily driver. But I love the Note, and I do like the stylus. And maybe this one I won't be able to put the stylus in backwards. Because I broke my
That video 5. Was awesome.
Oh, man.
Oops.
Oh, man. Now, what would be interesting, and this is the rumor, Type-C connector.
Mm.
Oh, finally. God.
Well, you know, I realized the reason they didn't do it on the Galaxy S7 was because they wanted to fit in the Gear VR, which uses a micro USB connector.
Yep. So I guess that means we're getting a new Gear VR,
yeah,
too.
Right?
Yep.
I got the HTC 10. I want to be open. I love HTC, and everybody was saying, oh, this is the best HTC in years, and I'd agree with that. You know what's nice now? Top-of-the-line Android phones are all good. I wouldn't say there's anything wrong with any of them. This one does have a Type-C connector, which I really am a fan of the Type-C connector. Unlike this S7, it's an IPS LCD screen, not an OLED screen. And I do like the OLED screen on the S7. Let me unlock the S7 here. What do you use? What's your? I bet you're a 6P kind of guy, Ron, because you seem like a pure guy.
Yeah, I always have some kind of Nexus phone. My daily driver is actually the 5X because it's smaller.
Right.
And I definitely enjoy that size more, but I would love to have an aluminum version. That would be super awesome.
That's one of the things I do like about this. This is nice.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the HTC 10. They did a great job with that thing.
I agree.
And especially from HTC, I never really expected anything that good, and it's really great.
I miss the front-facing speakers. They got rid of those, and now they have a tweeter and a woofer.
Yeah.
I don't get that. That's kind of dopey. the camera's good. It's the 6P sensor. They have the Zoes. The Zoes are here. I still think the S7 is a better sensor. Battery life is better on the S7. I do like a long battery, and the S7's really been the champ. Although HTC C10 is no slouch. It gets through the day anyway. It's just with a little bit less by the end of the day.
Yeah, the S7, it's a shame, the version we got. If you want to be a real like connoisseur, you need to import the Exynos version, which is faster and has better battery life and just totally kills the Snapdragon
really?
820. Oh, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's a lot nicer. But
last year's S6 was Exynos, but the Exynos, I didn't like the S6. The Exynos couldn't keep up, but the new Exynos probably is better, huh?
Yeah, benchmarks are better than the 820, In our test, at least, the battery life was way better.
Way better is big. Always want better. I will also be very interested in the Note 6. And if it comes out August 15th, that's a little earlier than last year. That would be good timing. So if you can wait a few more months.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. Did it say they were changing anything or adding anything?
Well, just the Type-C connector.
Okay.
That's big.
Great.
Yeah.
It's Samsung. They're not big on giant, massive changes. It's just they just keep.
No, you got a winner, go with it, man.
Yeah, true. They are winning, so they don't need.
And also, when you got a loser, go with it, right? They don't. They go with it. They've had a few losers in their time. The S5. What a terrible phone that was. So let me see what 9to5. This is a rumor, of course. It's a leak. What 9to5? I guess it'll have Nut Roll on it. Android N. This comes from Evan Blass, Ev Leaks. He's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can guess. It'll have a Snapdragon 820.
Wait a minute. Get ready. 5.8-inch display, bigger display, and 4,000 milliamp hour battery, biggest battery yet. I'm liking that. 12-megapixel camera. Micro SD slot is back, as it was with the S7. Also a choice between Exynos and Snapdragon 823. What's the 823?
Whoa, what?
What?
No, that's not a real
thing. Is
that
a typo? Is that a typo? Because the 820 is...
That's not...
You know, what do you think about this, Ron? Because I've been saying this, and I think this is true. I think all the Android flagship phones got screwed by the 810. That turned out to be a bum chip.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was way too hot. It throttled all the time.
HTC and others really suffered from that.
Yeah, we've had like a whole lost year of Android flagships.
Lost year. That's right.
Because Qualcomm needed to rush it out the door in order to get that 64-bit tag. So they grabbed ARM CPU cores off the shelf and just kind of shoved it into a chip and shoved it out the door. And we're like, it's 64-bit. We did it.
Yeah.
This year, they're back to using their own cores, and things are a lot cooler and nicer. And yeah, the 820 is a way better chip.
I don't know what the 823 is. They're also going to use the same. Oh, no, it is. There is an 823. There is an 823, and it will be first in the Note 6, according to...
This is the first. This is the first we've heard of this. This is not like a for-real thing anyone's heard of before. So who knows what's going to be different?
What?
Up to 3 gigahertz. Wow. Okay,
ooh.
That would be super-duper fast.
Ooh. They also will do a slightly higher clocking on the Exynos than the S7 as well. So don't get too attached to your phone, kids. There's a new one every day.
Leo, did you Did you see that the feds are apparently said to be taking a second look at Google search?
This is from Politico. Mm-hmm. Not normally considered one of the big Google reporter outlets, but this is what
they've
they
got good Fed contacts, though.
They know they're in D.C. FTC asking questions about whether Google has abused its dominance in the internet search market.
Apparently, they've been meeting with representatives of a major U.S. company.
Can you say Yahoo? No, it must be Bing.
No, yeah, they said major. Google's it wouldn't practices. Be Yahoo.
Oh, burn! yeah, obviously it's Bing. And that's what really bugs me. The same thing in the EU, that the EU's actions against Google all came from complaints from Microsoft.
Well, although in Europe, I think my sense is there's a much more receptive environment. So Microsoft might be the one.
It was an easy nudge. Bringing,
right. But lots of countries, they feel Google is too dominant.
Yeah.
Because they dominate, you know, the search market in lots of smaller European countries. Even more so than,
much more than
I mean,
here.
Some countries, I think it's like 90%.
Yeah, even in France, yeah. Mm-hmm. Where it's only 60 or 70% here because of Bing, I guess. Well, that's, you know, in a way you could say Microsoft brought it on because it was the results in the EU that apparently stimulated this FTC second look.
Mm-hmm.
But the FTC will not comment because agency investigations are non-public. But apparently, according to the reports, they've been meeting with companies, more than one, concerning Google's dealings over Android as well. That's the other thing. The EU slapped mm-hmm. Google for predatory practices with Android.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I don't know what Ron, what you think of that, but the Android case, you know, a bunch of it was about basically forcing people to take Google Play as part of the deal, which everyone kind of compared to Microsoft forcing people to take, you know, the browser right. effectively.
Very similar.
Well, the difference is that Windows is not open source and Android is. And right. if you don't want Google right. Play, you are free to go grab the Android source code and kind of make your own version and make your own app store. And Amazon does mm-hmm. that with the Fire stuff. So
true. Okay, but wait. But if you do that, true, and I agree with you, and I think Google's getting beat up for doing something that Apple doesn't get beat up for doing only because they have an open source version.
Right.
But one of the things Google does do is if you do make an AOSP open source version phone, you can never use that mm-hmm. company now is banned from doing a Google services version.
That they could absolutely.
And that was one thing
about.
The EU didn't like.
That's probably their strongest thing.
Yeah.
Harsh.
And actually, I've heard Amazon has a real hard time getting Fire devices built because so many companies are under right. the Google Play contract. And yeah. they're just like, nope, we can't build that for you. We're sorry.
So that's...
And yeah, it's really lame. Yeah, that they could definitely get beat up for.
But you do have to... I have to give Google some cred for making an open source operating system, supporting it, keeping it up out there.
And Europe had to bend over backwards even to... I mean, they described the claim so that it would only apply to Google.
Right.
So it was only applied to companies that have an open source operating system.
Right.
Well, there's only one of those.
You may remember in the previous investigation, the FTC did rule against Google, but it was a slap on the wrist, a very minor fine and a few things that Google had to do going forward. In fact, some people complained. Remember the Wall Street Journal, mm-hmm. also a hereditary enemy of Google, wrote an article saying some FTC lawyers had argued for stronger sanctions. So maybe they're back at the table. I don't know. An investigation doesn't mean anything. It's just an investigation.
And I got to say, I feel like there's far more, if you want to go after a company for a dominant position in some growing and highly relevant market, you'd probably wind up going after Facebook before you would Google. Not that search isn't still relevant, but it doesn't, you know, there's with apps and social services and people are finding things in a lot different ways than a Google search box.
Love, this is from Recode. Irv Azoff, who is a superstar agent He's the guy who talks like Columbo, by the way. Dear YouTube, an open letter from Irv. You have built a business that works really well for you and Google, but it doesn't work well for artists. When the artist sends a takedown, it should be a stay down.
Nice.
Nice. This is the old mainstream music industry talking to the new kid in town. If music matters to YouTube, why not give musicians the same choice you give yourselves? Taylor Swift should be able to decide which of her songs are available for free and which are part of a paid service. Or she should be able to opt out of YouTube if you won't give her the choice. But artists can't opt out of YouTube. Because of the DMCA, the only way for an artist to keep a song off YouTube is for that artist to send YouTube a notice every time that song is uploaded by a different user. That is impossible.
Nope.
Yeah.
No. Nope. No. That's just not true. Totally wrong.
The content ID system that you flaunt is meaningless when YouTube continues to hide behind the safe harbor provisions of the DMCA. Well, that's why they're there. The safe harbor provisions give YouTube a safe harbor.
Yeah, it's funny how I actually wrote something about who's the guy who runs the Record Industry Association.
The RIA. Who is it these days? Is it Ted Nugent?
Anyway.
Satan? Is it Satan? No?
Yes. Yeah, Satan. It's close anyway.
So he was saying similar things about, and you know what they really want to do?
Michael Gondry?
They want to get rid of the DMCA and Safe Harbor altogether.
Right.
That's what
Azoff is basically saying.
And radio, if they could.
Yeah.
Like, if they could, they would just go back and uninvent radio and the compulsory license.
Carrie Sherman is the
right.
Yeah,
they want to fight the last war, not this war. Actually, it's two wars ago, I think.
I think they're fighting Korea. It's the Korean conflict.
I don't know what these guys are complaining about. I really think like Content ID is pretty much the perfect system because you can upload a song to it and it will repeatedly, automatically, instantly slap down every video that contains that song. Or you can choose to monetize. You can choose to totally take it down or choose to monetize it with your own ads. It's a great compromise.
Actually, Hank Green, the YouTube star and podcaster and author, and for all I know, he's in the circus as well. He wrote a letter responding to Irving, saying exactly what you just finished saying, that yes, you can actually keep it off YouTube.
Yeah.
Or you can choose to monetize it. The whole system is designed to do that.
It may not be perfect, but the fact that everybody hates it, music industry and content creators, means it's probably a pretty successful compromise, you know? I think it does the job.
If there's a big problem with YouTube, it's false takedown.
Right. We get a lot.
I mean, there are companies that spend all their time forcing YouTube to take things down, and they don't have the right to do that.
Speaking of YouTube, Amazon's launching a service for content creators, some say to compete with YouTube. I don't think it is actually a direct competitor, called Video Direct.
You don't think it's a direct competitor?
No, and I'll tell you why. We were looking at it. I mean, it'd be great for us. So there's three ways you can play on Video Direct. One is you can put your content there for free, and Amazon Prime members will be able to see it for free. And YouTube Amazon has said they're going to put $1 million a month aside to distribute among the top 100 most subscribed to content providers. So there'll be some potential upside for you, but you'll get free distribution on a huge platform, Amazon Prime. The second way is you could do a paid service. They will let you sell your shows right next to the shows from HBO and CBS and everybody else. And the third way is more YouTube-like. Amazon will put advertising on it, and you'll share a 55-45 split in favor of Amazon revenue from that advertising. That's very much like YouTube, but here's why I say it's not probably for everybody. A, we wouldn't be able to – we'd have to cut the ads out of our stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not a big deal. We have some ad-free content, you know, our highlights, reels and stuff. We could put that up there.
What do you mean? You can't have competitive ads?
No.
Oh, okay.
And the second problem is you have to have closed captioning.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. Which is, I'm all for. I'm not against closed captioning. That's great. And the only reason we don't do it is hideously expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and they're not offering some sort of automated system like YouTube does. You'd have to pay for it. So, at least that when we went through the, as soon as I saw this yesterday, we went through, Lisa and I sat down and went through the terms of service.
I wrote this up too, and I said that it was a competitor for the professional side of
that's
YouTube.
That's who it's for.
If you actually go to the Amazon site and click the upload button, you have to make an account. And to make this account, you need to have a company name.
Yeah.
And you need to connect a bank account to Amazon for direct deposit. And you need to give them like a tax ID for tax information for all the money you're going to make. So that cuts out the whole like viral cat video side
it's
of
definitely
YouTube.
Not that. And that's exactly my point.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, but if you're a Machinima or TYT Network or one of these like pro or semi-pro YouTubers, then you could jump in on this.
Right.
In fact, they've got one of their content partners is Machinima.
Yep.
Oh yeah, I'm reading off the partner list.
Yeah. But and maybe they'll change the closed captioning. That may be just an ADA requirement that Amazon has to adhere to for some reason.
So maybe you could upload it to YouTube and get them to do the closed captioning and then...
Oh, their closed captioning's so bad, though.
It's terrible.
It is, yeah.
That's a disservice to deaf people. Yeah. That's just... no one should have to read those captions. That's part of the problem, too, is, of course, our content is technical and requires, and there'd be a lead time also. So it's not great for news content because...
Right.
We'd have to send it off, get it closed captioned, and then get it up there.
I must admit, I can't decide whether this is like someone at Amazon thought, we do Kindle Direct Publishing. Why don't we do something similar for video, and we'll just see what happens? Like, I don't know if it's a kind of let's throw it out there and see what happens, or if they're actually going to invest some time and resources in it.
The thing that gets me is that I feel like the Amazon Prime video interface is horrible. And now you're going to mix in all these kind of YouTube channels with TV shows and movies and all this other stuff. It's not, their interface is not ready for this, like at all.
Well, that's the other reason it's not a YouTube competitor. YouTube really is optimized for browsing.
Yeah.
And it works great that way. To watch this on a Roku or a Fire TV or my television smart TV software is not going to be as satisfying.
It feels almost like it's more of a Netflix competitor.
Yeah.
Where they kind of want it to be. Yeah. I mean, they certainly want Prime Video to be.
I think why not? Look, it's clear that if you're Amazon or Netflix or anybody in this space, you want to have as much content, original exclusive content as you can. And why not put it on there, except for that issue you raised, which is it makes user interface
I actually wrote something, I can't remember if it was yesterday or the entire video market, whether it's long form or TV style shows or cable or YouTube videos or, Facebook Live. I mean, it's just a massive kind of, if you had a map, all the borders and boundaries that used to exist would be erased. It's just a massive kind of redrawing of the landscape where everyone is effectively trying to compete with everyone else. Even Facebook Live now is not live. Lots of companies are using it to upload archive stuff. It's fascinating because it's so chaotic. And literally everyone is competing with everyone else.
Disney getting out of the video game business. I guess the Infinity. I just bought the Infinity stuff. In fact, we had the
collector's item.
I know. I guess that's it. Hey, leave it in the box. Don't open the box. Crap. Let's take a break. When we come back, your tips, your picks, your suggestions, anything you'd like to pass along to our vast viewing audience. Ron Amadio from Ars Technica. From Fortune.com, Mr. Matthew Ingram. Our show today brought to you by Blue Apron. I know you're getting hungry. You're ready to eat. It happens to me every day around this time, and then I think, oh, crap, I don't have anything in the fridge. I got to go to the store. I got to plan a menu. I got to plan a meal. Buy it, go home, cook it. It's just a pain. Then I remember, oh, wait a minute, today's Blue Apron Day. And I go, yay. I love seeing that Blue Apron box on the front step. Refrigerated, fresh ingredients.
And great stuff. You get to go to the Blue Apron website. You can see this. Every ingredient you need, even if it's like one scallion, it's all in there. Little bottles of flavor things. And it's so fun. And then you can, even if you're not a cook, in fact, this really will help you be a better cook. You follow the ingredients, the recipe card. There's videos on the site if you need some help. You'll be using ingredients that are unique and wonderful. Each meal costs about $10. High-quality ingredients, never frozen. Even the fish and meat is all refrigerated and fresh from local farms. Step-by-step instructions take you about a half an hour to 40 minutes to make. Blue Apron delivers almost anywhere in the continental United States. All their seafood is sourced sustainably. The beef is raised humanely. The chickens are free-range. I mean, it's good stuff. Pork is raised naturally. They use regenerative farming practices for the produce. I mean, they're really getting great stuff. And there's less waste because they're shipping you exactly what you need for the recipe. Cook meals like crispy cod and cabbage slaw tacos with pepita, pineapple, and avocado salsa. I want that tonight. Or how about Middle Eastern chicken and chickpea stew with pita croutons? See, you might not ever think of that, but you got all the ingredients. You make it. It's delicious. The house smells wonderful. If it's date night, you're going to make a new friend. They have family plans, too, with kid-friendly ingredients. It's a great way to get kids cooking. And we're going to get you your first two meals free. Free shipping, even. Go to blueapron.com/twit. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create amazing home-cooked meals. It's a way. It's really love. It's cooking up love. I'm not kidding. Grilled brie cheese and strawberry jam sandwiches with arugula and walnut salad. Okay, I'll take that right now. Right now. Go to blueapron.com/twit for your first two meals free. Love them. Blue Apron. All right. I'm going to wrap things up here. Matthew, got anything you want to plug or talk about or software you use, hardware you like?
I'm so behind, you know, hardware and software wise. We could talk about, you know, Linux Mint or.
We were talking about that. I mean, we were both saying how.
I do like Mint.
I'm amazed that you use it. You use Linux on the desktop in lieu of like Windows or Mac.
Yep. Yep. I have a MacBook as well. And I love Mac. At one point, I decided to try and run Ubuntu, and then I switched to Linux Mint. But it's not that new or exciting. I actually had a number because I thought Jeff's not here. So
give us a number. I love it.
So I came across, since we were talking about YouTube, I came across a research report from Bernstein about YouTube. And, of course, it's hard to get sort of hard numbers out of YouTube about numbers of videos, you know, the size of the archive, that type of stuff. So this analyst, I came up with his own estimates based on research that he did, going through a bunch of different YouTube videos and extrapolating. And his estimate is that as of this quarter, YouTube has about 2 billion videos corresponding to 12 billion minutes or 197 million hours of content.
Wow.
I just thought those numbers were... Yeah, really mind-bogglingly large.
See, in a way, that's Amazon doesn't want to do that, right? That's not what Amazon's trying to do.
No, and if even if you were to try to do that...
You couldn't.
YouTube is so far ahead of you already.
Yeah.
You know, you could still have a half-decent service, but you're not going to do that.
Yeah.
YouTube videos have been watched an estimated 39 trillion times.
YouTube keeps a running... stat page up and run, I think, all the time. It's like youtube.com/stats or something, or maybe it's in the press site where they just have, you know, like every second 10 billion hours uploaded, of YouTube video is watched or something. It's amazing, and the numbers keep going up.
Wow. Wow. I want that site. YouTube stats. Maybe it's on the press site. I would love to just have that up on the screen.
Yeah, just search YouTube stats.
Here it is in the press site. It's youtube.com/yt/press/statistics.html, but this doesn't look like it's real time. I'd love a real time. Wouldn't you love to see that?
Just
that
would be cool.
Well, it'd be moving so fast, yeah.
Yeah. Be awesome. Ron, something you want to plug? Something you like these days, you're excited about, nobody knows about, but you?
I'm going to be a huge dork and recommend a Star Trek podcast.
Nice.
That started.
Not it's, Star
it's
Wars.
Like 30 episodes in, so yeah, it's pretty new. It's called The Greatest Generation. And the tagline is a Star Trek podcast by two guys that are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast.
That's the kind of guys so I want to listen to.
You know, it's not like the, I'm sure there's like super nerd stuff out there where they're, you know, really into it, but this is just kind of two guys making fun of Star Trek and kind of revisiting it since, like, if you are my age, you probably saw The Next Generation on TV when you were kind of a kid and a lot of the stuff went over your head. And now they kind of go back and look at everything and are great at coming up with running jokes. And now they've done the whole HD transfer to Blu-ray. So, like, stuff that looked fine on your TV back then, now you look at it in HD and it's like, oh, that's definitely a piece of cardboard.
What's cool is they go. It's an episode. So are they watching together and talking about it, or are they just, or you should you watch it first and then listen to the podcast?
I like to watch the, you know,
while you're listening.
They go episode by episode. Yeah, nice. I wouldn't recommend playing it that much since it's definitely crude humor.
Oh yeah, I could tell from the titles alone. Yeah.
It makes me sad that you said watching The Next Generation when you were a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. I watched the original Star Trek when I was a kid.
Star Trek podcast by two guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast.
Oh, they got the nice NPR sound. That's good.
Adam,
they comment on that a lot too.
Yeah. They sound like an NPR podcast about Star Trek.
It's very funny though. It's been pretty awesome, and they're only 30 episodes in, so you know they started episode one and worked their way up. They just got through the horrible season one, where everything's made out of cardboard and yeah, season one was a hot mess, but it's getting good now. So awesome.
I have three numbers as well. One comes from our chat room. Creamy Corn Cob says PewDiePie's total views on YouTube. Total views 12 billion. Mm-hmm. 47,983,037. Oh, make that 38. Oh, make that 39. 12 billion PewDiePie views. He's been seen more than all the sitcoms combined.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Wow.
It's just mind-boggling. Of course, it's the same 58 kids watching it a billion times each.
Well, and of course, TV folks will say you can't compare YouTube video to...
Of course not.
...a Nielsen TV viewer.
Of course you can't. I agree with him as an old-time media guy. Damn it. Here's another number, $268 million. That's how much the Japanese satellite cost that was destroyed by a software update.
What?
The Japanese X-ray telescope Hitomi has been declared lost. It disintegrated in orbit, torn apart while spinning out of control. Early analysis points to bad data in a software package pushed shortly after an instrument probe was extended from the rear of the satellite.
Oops.
So they bricked it and it crashed?
They bricked it and it crashed. Wow. So, kids, don't root your satellite while it's in space.
Don't run as root on your satellite.
Never. Yes, Matt. Matthew Ingram, yes. And finally...
It was a Windows update.
it was a Windows update. It was the Windows 10 upgrade. The most expensive Windows 10 upgrade. And here's another number. 218,000. The all-time Donkey Kong record broken. Mm-hmm. Wes Copeland. Actually, I'm sorry. It's 1,218,000. Actually, you're missing the one because when they designed Donkey Kong, thought anybody to go to seven digits. 1.2 million, and he played for how long straight? I think 36 hours, something like that.
Wow.
Wait a minute. No, I can't be right. But he has been the Donkey Kong champion for a long time. If you saw the documentary, The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters, in 2007, the pair who held the record in that show are now 18th and 19th. So apparently in the intervening 9 years, there have been a lot of people working on this. It's an all-new record. He did it on May 5th. I'm trying to find how long he played for. I don't think he was that long, actually. Oh, the thing that's amazing, he never died. It was all with the same character. You didn't lose a single Mario in the game.
One quarter?
Well.
Yeah, one quarter, obviously. The record has to be one quarter. But he didn't even lose a life. He's going to retire, he said. That's it. You can't get any better than that. This is a record that will never be broken. My last record score. I don't believe I can put up a game any higher than this, says Wes Copeland. He's the king. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes this episode. I love it that the one is missing because nobody ever thought anyone would get anything like that. Yeah, that's a good question. Was he wearing headphones or did he have to listen to that stupid music over and 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 over? Thank you so much for being here. Matthew Ingram, fortune.com. Always a pleasure. Look at the bright side, the lake. The ice is melting, and the lake will soon be ready for canoeing.
I hope so.
We can only hope. Good to have you, as always. Thanks for joining us. Are you wearing sandals with socks today? I always imagine you wearing sandals with socks. I don't even know if you ever do that.
I try not to do that.
Okay.
I sort of have a thing about socks and sandals. So.
Good. But you are wearing a Laughing Squid t-shirt, so that's good.
I sure am.
That's always a good thing. And thank you, Ron Amadio. Love having you on the show, ArsTechnica.com.
Anytime.
What are you working on?
Google I.O. stuff. Wall to wall, all day. Starts next week. Things are going to get crazy.
Exciting.
Enjoy the way Ars Technica looks today.
Oh, no.
It's going to be gone very soon.
It is a little, but it's classic. I mean, this is a classic look. I'm going to miss it.
Yeah. So redesign's happening, so stay tuned. That'll be fun.
Oh, no.
And, flying out, Tuesday?
Good.
So that'll be cool. And I'll have to track down Jason and everybody else.
Yeah. Say hi to everybody. They'll be down there. And that reminds me that we will be doing the show later than usual because of Google I.O. coverage. Our keynote coverage begins at 10 a.m. Pacific on Wednesday. That's 1 p.m. Eastern time, 1700 UTC. And then Windows Weekly around about noon Pacific, around about 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern time, 2100 UTC for This Week in Google next week, a little later than usual. Thanks, everybody, for being here. We'll see you next time on Twig.